Committee on Health and Human Services Budget and Policy will be in order. We actually have just two bills today, Senate File 180 with Senator Benson. Senator Benson? And Senator Scheid has one up, too. Good morning, Senator Benson.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. Let's remember to keep our microphones close. I place before you Senate File 180. The bill directs the Commissioner of Human Services to issue an RFP for the purpose of obtaining software and services to improve the detection and rejection of improper Medicaid payment requests. It is financed primarily through a negotiated vendor performance recovery. We do have a fiscal note. That fiscal note can only address known costs at this point. It does not address cost savings, and we will have someone come up to speak to that at a later point in the hearing. First of all, the first question with anything that comes before us is there a need? Well, in 2008, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services issued a report that said Minnesota currently has 7 full-time equivalents that are used for audits. They referred 45 cases for review and recovered approximately $4.7 million via their current activities. This is approximately 0.07% of the Medicaid budget. Often, the settlements are, this information is tracking down payments after they're made. Settlements often only settle for partial recovery of those losses. And so if we move legislation forward that attacks the front end of those fraudulent payments, I think we will see significant increase in those recoveries by reducing improper payments and giving us better tracking for recovering even those payments made in recovery. Are the new systems better than the system we currently use? The screens they use are based on incoming payment requests using statistical analysis and matching it to real-time data, which increases our likelihood of detection. It also will free up staff in the long run. They don't have to waste their time finding errors and fraud and waste. They can focus on serving people. The technology that you'll hear more about has been used in financial services industry, forensic accounting, private insurance, and is now moving into state systems where it's being used quite effectively. IBM has built systems for Aetna, and has done an analysis of a home health care and durable medical equipment that found 18% of the claims to be suspect. Now, in Minnesota, we're not going to find the high level of waste, fraud, and abuse that we might find in other states, but we can still look towards a prevention rate of 1% to 3% of our budget and a recovery rate of approximately 0.5%. So I'm going to turn the microphones over to two of our testifiers, Joe Zilka and John Doyeski. Could you repeat your names for the record, please?
Welcome, Mr. Joleski.
It's Doleshi.
Doleshi. Yeah. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and the committee. Appreciate the opportunity to testify on behalf of this legislation. And I'm a local Minnesota boy my whole life, and I support SAS Institute as the company, and I'm focused solely for government and supporting the state of Minnesota government as well as the state of Wisconsin. SAS Institute's the largest private software company in the world, over $2 billion in revenue. Over the last 35 years of its existence, it's focused entirely on advanced analytics software. SAS supports all industries in advanced analytics, and the top two industries actually are finance and government. So those are the two we have the most involvement, engagement, and successes in. The state of Minnesota is a significant customer of SAS's and is used in approximately 10 different departments, but not currently in the area of compliance or fraud from that perspective. We've been asked to testify, and I invited Joe Zilka, who's been with the SAS Institute working at Advanced Analytics for the last 10 years, and he's currently the program manager for our fraud solutions. So I'll turn it over to Joe at this point in time.
Well, thank you, Mr. Dolesky. And Mr. Zilka, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name, please, for
the record. Madam Chair. My name is Joe Zilka. I also represent SAS Institute, and I am the program manager for fraud solutions for our company. I have a few PowerPoint slides I want to go through that will support my testimony. First off, I think in order to understand the scope of the problem, Senator Benson did touch on some of those statistics. From a national perspective, a national weighted average out of the United States Department of Health and Human Services Agency financial report, weighted averages for improper payments in different areas around Medicaid fee-for-service is about 4.4%, Medicaid-managed care 1%, and Medicaid eligibility 5.9%. Comparing that to Minnesota, the PERM report, payment error rate measurement, an audit that's done around areas of data processing, medical necessity for procedures and services, as well as Medicaid eligibility. That report for Minnesota came up with about 0.5% of improper payments for Medicaid fee-for-service of $4.6 billion to the tune of $25 million. Managed care was estimated at 0%, and Medicaid eligibility was down to 1.64% of $8.8 billion. So again, it is a $100 million problem, and of course we commend the efforts that Minnesota has taken to combat improper payments. They are well below the national average, so they're doing very good things in combating improper payments. One note about the PERM payment error rate measurement is that, again, it does focus on data processing, medical necessity, as well as some Medicaid eligibility. We're going to start talking a little bit about fraud. Fraudsters these days are a little bit more complex in how they game the system. Some of the audits that are out there may not be equipped to detect the complex types of fraud that are being perpetrated, so we estimate that fraudulent component to be a little bit higher. The National Healthcare Anti-Fraud Association estimates that 3% of all healthcare spending in the nation is fraudulent activity. So again, there's a couple different numbers that are out there. The fact that there is fraud out there that is happening that we don't know about, it is very difficult sometimes to estimate the exact number due to fraud. At any rate, a 1, 2, 3% of a $6, 7, $8 billion program is a $100 million problem. So again, I think that talking about some of the simplistic fraudulent activity and things that current claims processing systems can detect. Overutilization by providers, upcoding of services, unbundling of services. So these are some very simplistic methods can be used to detect the type of fraud, waste, and abuse that some of these providers may be perpetrating. Where it gets a little bit more complex and where new technology is needed to assist the investigators in triaging some of this potentially fraudulent activity is around falsification of claims, billing for services that are not rendered. Unless someone actually goes out and asks the participant or the recipient of those services if they received a service on a particular date, there's really no way to detect with some of the rules-based systems that are in place whether or not that happened. Kickbacks and collusion have also become pretty apparent in Medicaid as well as Medicare. Several high-profile stories about collusion between providers and, for example, durable medical equipment supply companies have been in the news. And again, those collusive type of fraudulent activity are very difficult to detect in a post-payment scenario. Again, from the participant side, we've seen an uptick in the states that we have spoken to around eligibility. So we're working with a state on some eligibility verification using some analytics and statistical analysis to determine if people are actually supplying the right information. Again, so here we're focusing on stopping those payments from going out the door even before the service is rendered. So the providers typically when, you know, there's some payment is stopped to a provider because the service is in question, the provider's already out the money even if they legitimately provided it. Here if we move the move that up to do some eligibility verification, then the provider obviously will not be providing services to ineligible individuals. So how do we fight this fraud, waste, and abuse? Again, we're proposing using some advanced techniques and advanced analytics. A new approach is certainly needed. Innovation is required in new methods of detection and prevention. Current efforts in Minnesota are very good, but I think it can also be improved. With the technology and the collusive nature of the fraud rings out there today, again, these high-end tools are required to keep up with the ever-changing face of fraud. An integrated and multifaceted approach is necessary. A lot of the systems in place are required these days, of course, to have business rules which would flag upcoding, unbundling, and a lot of the simplistic type of improper payment detection methods that are there. Those are good and they're needed and they're necessary. However, they do lead to a larger number of false positives when used by themselves. So that, of course, leads to providers having an extra burden in terms of proving that they were actually legitimate services that were provided. So adding into that a couple different components of advanced analytics, we talk about looking at some anomaly detection. What is anomaly detection? Let's take a group of providers and compare them to their peers. So if we've got an ear, nose, and throat doctor that is sending 90% of his patients out for a chest x-ray, while his peer group is only sending 10%, that is something to be looked at. We're not saying it's fraud. However, if we use that in conjunction with maybe some of the business rules that were coded that this provider had tripped, we start to get a better picture as to the potential fraud or improper payment with this activity. We also leverage, states have been leveraging some of their historical knowledge on fraudulent investigations. So as cases are investigated and tracked, we know what attributes associated with the transaction or the entity, if it's a participant or a provider or a supplier, we have those data attributes. We know what fraud looks like, and we can model that so that as new data and claims and transactions come through the system, we can create it, run it through the model and create a score and say this looks this has a high propensity or a high probability that this might be fraud. So again, we're combining these different components, this multifaceted approach, to create a more robust prioritization of cases that we think are fraud. Again, we're not saying it is fraud, waste, and abuse or fraud by itself. We're saying that we think these are the cases that investigators should concentrate many of their efforts. Last component is link analysis. Social network analysis is another term that's used. This is really a visualization tool to understand the relationships between different entities within our system. So it would be a patient and a provider, or a provider and a referral off to a durable medical equipment supply company, a patient and a pharmacist, right? So all these individuals are linked by transactions within the system. Unless you plot this out on a piece of paper, it's very difficult to visualize these relationships. Link analysis and visualization tools allow us to see those relationships. Now, if one of those individuals had been referred for fraud in Medicaid or in perhaps some other government program, we can highlight that fact. In our experiences with other agencies, if someone had committed fraud, it's prudent to look at some of the individuals that are related or tied to that individual within their social network. So if I'm associated with several known fraudsters, that would increase my fraud risk score. So again, we're combining all these different aspects and detection mechanisms to create a list to be examined for fraud. And lastly, as Senator Benson mentioned as well, we're talking about moving this technology up the service chain. If our service chain is eligibility, verification, validation, and application, that's prior to services being rendered. Point of service would be at the doctor's office. Prior to payment, of course, is a claim that comes through, and we might do some examination prior to paying it. And then, of course, there's the post-payment retrospective analysis, which, again, amounts to pay and chase. So we could take the technology and the analytics and analysis that we talked about on the previous slide and actually move that up into the prepayment phase, and we can move it up to the eligibility verification phase. So, again, it's all about keeping money in the door as opposed to the less lucrative pay and chase scenarios. Again, so what does this provide? Really, it's more prioritized cases of fraud, waste, and abuse for investigators to work. Again, no system will tell you a transaction or an entity is fraudulent. There's a lot of institutional knowledge that the folks that investigate fraud have, and we certainly need that human element to look at it. This will certainly provide a more prioritized list of cases. If the hit rate on cases is 1 in 10, we can certainly expect that to be a much higher percentage of cases that we can investigate that are more fruitful in our fraud investigation efforts. It also reduces the false positives. Again, so it's more of an efficiency gain for the state when we start examining fraud, waste, and abuse. Using that multifaceted approach, in our experience, has resulted in reducing false positive by 10 times. That's quite an efficiency gain when we talk about the investigators that are going after fraud. And again, as we assemble this data and for analytics and create models and do anomaly detection, we can certainly make that data available to investigators. Some of the investigation agencies that we've spoke with go from different system to different system, different screen to different screen, to try to investigate that particular transaction or fraudulent alert that they have. Quite time-consuming. The fact that all the data has been consolidated for analysis can be made available in a single screen, which really improves the efficiencies of the investigators in that are working these cases. Just a couple of our experiences with some agencies. The state of Illinois does thousands of investigations for preventing fraud and financial audits and eligibility reviews. And they really wanted a solution that looked at used their historical data to create those predictive models. They also wanted that link analysis or social network to uncover fraudulent provider claims within the Medicaid system, claims overpayment at the transaction level, as well as looking at that network of criminals. With this approach, they're looking at 90 to 95% hit rate on their audits, which is quite an astounding number, considering many of the states that we deal with have a much, much lower hit rate in terms of their investigative efficiencies. We've worked with another state. Again, they were really relying on exception processing. So let's look at, once a claim is paid, let's validate that claim. Maybe it triggered a business rule or a red flag to investigate. So what they did is they actually deployed some of these analytics and analytic application to help build some models using that historical data, as well as find some emerging patterns of fraud. As some of these systems get put in place, these fraudsters get privy to the detection mechanisms and learn how to fly under the radar, if you will, to perpetrate this fraud. So having a robust system that is flexible can help find those emerging patterns of fraud. And this particular state identified $27 million in overpayments to providers, as well as preventing $14 million in losses through enhancing the eligibility screening process. And lastly, we dealt with another state on the East Coast, their Medicaid system. They were interested in addressing the personal care services, community support services. Again, they're applying analytics to identify the most suspicious billers, as well as out-of-sequence events and rare combinations of diagnoses and procedures for fraud. Within the PCS system, they identified over $46 million of potential loss in out-of-sequence events, as well as $71 million in potentially unnecessary services. In terms of the community support services, they identified over $14 million of potential loss. And that's all I have, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Zelka. And I do have a question on your first, the scope of the problem in Minnesota's PIRM findings of 2009. Were you surprised by that, those figures, or is that within the realm of possibility and what the other states are facing?
I was surprised by those figures. I typically don't see agencies that are that effective. But again, I'm not trying to minimize the work that Minnesota has done in this area. But again, it is a somewhat limited sample that is used for this estimated analysis. So again, I think it is characteristic of the efforts, and I think Minnesota does a lot to minimize the improper payments, but I think that there is some additional fraud that could be found.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't think this is typical of many other states.
Okay. And either to you, Mr. Zelka, or Mr. Dolesky, the SAS Institute, is there competition in this world that you live in?
Yeah, there's a number of companies that participate and provide solutions in this space, either from a couple different paradigms or as comprehensive a set of paradigms as we provide. So, yes.
Mm-hmm. What was that in English?
And Senator Benson, you just received the fiscal note.
Yes.
Are you surprised or pleasantly surprised. I see in 2012 there's 148,000, and then it goes down. Can you account for the decrease too? I would assume it's from the cost savings and the but-fors. And
it's my understanding that we have staff here who are better equipped to answer that question. If they wouldn't mind stepping forward, I will cede the microphone.
Madam Chair, members, Shannon Kojisoy from the Department of Human Services. And I was just asked, actually, there are no savings listed on this fiscal note, and I was asked just to share a little more information on why there are no cost avoidance savings listed. And it's just very difficult to predict cost avoidance savings of this type for this type of contract. This proposal will build on our current system, and we currently have over 2,000 edits. So we just can't predict what these new edits may be and how much they may add to cost avoidance or what cost avoidance they may achieve.
Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, would you pull the microphone up close to your mouth?
Sure.
And second, what does edits mean?
Edits, these are things in the system that will...
Flag?
Flag, thank you. Flag us of fraudulent activity.
And Madam Chair, 2,000 in what amount of time?
You know, we're getting into detail, and I don't want to misspeak, so I might ask one of my colleagues to come up and just share a little more information on the edit system, if that's okay.
That's fine. Thank you. And for the record, members, there is a quorum. So if you wouldn't mind. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Adrienne Alexander. I am the Healthcare Operations Division Director. And to your point, member, the checks or the flags that are that we call edits are actually the things that our claims processing system uses as rules. I believe the presentation mentioned that as a business rule type thing, but it's a check to determine different types of activities, and it allows us to pull out particular claims based on the requirements of things that we're looking for. Mm-hmm. And those edits are actually in the system. That over 2,000 number is not based on the volume. That's actually the ones that we have in the system on an ongoing basis.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Ms. Alexander. So that's 2,000 different flags, two different set of criteria that would call something to your attention. Is that what you mean?
Madam Chair and Representative.
Ms. Alexander.
Member, yes.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To either of the presenters from SAS, this bill calls for the Commissioner of Human Services to request proposals for a contract. Would I be correct in assuming that SAS is likely to be one of the businesses that will submit a proposal?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Yes, we would likely to be a respondent for an RFP, as we have in the past, actually.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Given that fact, could you give me some idea of what that contract is going to look like? I note, for instance, on the back of the page 2.1, 2.2, it indicates that the contract has got to have some risk of, or the vendor has to share some risk in the project's success. You know, is this going to be and I'm not looking for specifics, but is this contract going to be fee-based, contingency fee-based? Is it, what's the length of the contract? Are you using this kind of a contract in other states? Do you have a success rate? Do you handle the collections or the investigation? I mean, I just have no idea whatsoever what this contract might look like.
Mr. Dulesky.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. I think the nature, duration in terms of the contract would be defined by the state and DHS in terms of what parameters they're looking to optimize around. Those forms of contracts can take a number of different structures, whether it be based on outcome-based performance, which a lot of times in the sort of the recovery, the what we call pay and chase, it's after it's out the door, how much money do you collect? That's a fairly typical model, and one actually the federal government, CMS, is mandating every state to engage a company to provide for them. When you move into the area of trying to stop the payments from occurring in the beginning, it starts to become a little bit more difficult from an outcome-based perspective, especially if the focus is trying to operationalize the benefits, you know, such as, you know, the 2,000 edits that are in place today, adding some additional capabilities into that mix. So we don't know what the form and shape of the contract would be or the RFP contractual provisions, and that would be solely the state's goals and objectives as represented in the RFP process.
One final question,
Senator Newman.
Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that I really followed your answer all that well, but without, in effect, writing the commissioner a blank check, would you have any examples that you would be able to make available to the committee of the types of proposals that you have submitted in the past to other states, simply to give us an idea of you know, what we might be authorizing the commissioner to engage in?
Mr. Dolosky.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman.
Am I saying your name correctly, Dolosky?
Nobody does.
How do you say it again?
It's Dolashi, and it's actually phonetic if you're a Czech. Otherwise, I'm John. Thank you. Yeah, we would certainly be glad to pull together some of those kinds of documents and deliver it to the committee.
Madam Chair, I'd appreciate that very
much.
Thank
you. You bet. Senator Higgins.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Mr. Dolashi.
Thank you.
You said that there was a CMS mandate for this kind of work to be done in every state. Is that correct?
Mr. Dolashi.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. Yes, the kind of work we're talking about here is actually more preventative and probably more aggressive than CMS. CMS is looking at sort of the older model, which is pay and chase. But they are requiring every state to enter into a contract with a recovery vendor whose basic job is, after the payments have been made, their job, it's a collection function. And actually, we help partner with some of those organizations to help improve their diagnostics as to which are the more likely payments to be collected. But the latest thinking in terms of fraud, waste, and abuse, and even education for compliance, is trying to do it preemptively. So prior to payments being made, there, if you can stop the payment from being made, there's 100% recovery. It does make it more challenging from how do we calculate returns, and so it makes it much more difficult to score and determine. But the gains are much larger, and the goal for a collaboration between, from our perspective, a collaboration between a state and the vendor should be about how do we operationalize those kinds of systems and edits and so forth so they become part of the standard eligibility process, the claims process, and so forth, prior to payments going out the door.
Okay. Then, Madam Chair,
Senator Higgins.
I have a couple questions for Ms. Alexander then. Ms. Alexander, do you know if there's any existing federal money to help pay for this?
Ms. Alexander?
Madam Chair and Member, actually, I would have to check on that. I'm not exactly sure.
If you would,
I do
that'd be
believe
great.
That there are some options that we may be able to look into.
Okay. And then
Senator Higgins?
Do we, at this point, contract with a recovery vendor in the work that we do now?
Ms. Alexander.
Madam Chair and Member, we do have one contract from a recovery basis that we are involved in, but other than that, in terms of on the back end, no, we do not.
Madam Chair, Ms. Alexander,
Senator Higgins.
I'm unsure of what you meant by that. I was under the impression that a recovery vendor did all the work on the back end.
And I think
Ms. Alexander,
are we getting our ends turned around? Do you mean before the money goes out? I'm thinking after the money goes out.
I'm sorry. Could you give me a little bit more information about your question?
You said that You said that we didn't have a vendor after. I can't remember the wording now. Let's try it this way. Does our vendor try to collect money that has gone out in payment?
Okay. Ms. Alexander.
Thank you. And I believe that I should defer that question, Madam Chair and member, to my colleague, Vicki.
Okay.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name, please, for the record.
Sure. Vicki Kuhnerth from the Department of Human Services, and I'm a division director of performance measurement. Adrienne is a division director for the front end of prepayment claims processing.
Okay.
I'm a division director, and I'm responsible for the pay and chase part and provider fraud. The RAC contract is a brand new this year federal requirement that we are to start to contract on a contingency basis for investigation and recovery. So that's the back end. The scope of this bill is front end prepayment avoidance. My job is post payment review and pay and chase. And that there are three ongoing federal audits, and the RAC is one of the ongoing required federal audits. And we are to contract with vendors on a contingency basis, whereby if they identify and we can actually collect $100,000 in recovery, we can pay them a percentage of that. That is how the deal would work. And so we don't pay them up front. We pay them based on results.
Okay.
So that is one of the three federal audits that we will start later this year. We are asking for a little authorization from you to make sure we can operate those contracts.
Okay.
Senator Higgins.
So then my last question at this point then. Senator Benson, is this a department proposal?
Senator Benson?
This was not proposed by the department. This is part of a moving the risk forward, as it were, to focus on preventing money going out the door. When you do pay and chase, you usually don't get full recovery, and you use a tremendous number of resources to get those dollars back, as these ladies can attest to. So by using technology up front to screen for those who are eligible, look for fraudulent payments, we believe there can be additional recoveries that would free up more dollars for those who are in need.
Senator Sharon?
Thank you. I have a series of questions. Should I just proceed, or do you want me to run through the chair with each question?
No, please run through me.
Run through you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. My understanding is we're talking about a front-end process that I guess I'd like to go back to Ms. Alexander and make certain I understood what you said, is that the existing system that we have in place now has edits or rules that engage in trying to ferret out simpler processes as this new technology. Is that correct?
Ms. Alexander.
And Madam Chair and member, yes, that is correct.
Thank you, and Madam Chair. And do I understand that the data that's being presented on the scope of the problem indicates the success of that effort by the department? Is it measured against the United States DHS agency report nationwide?
Ms. Alexander.
Madam Chair and member, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, there's data that's been presented here in the overhead material that shows that the Minnesota PERM findings show us to be substantially below the state's measures in terms of our success. So the scope of the problem is not as significant as it is in the in the United States.
Ms. Alexander.
Madam Chair and member, yes.
And so, Madam Chair, I'm saying that there's a relationship between a process we have in place already and this achievement. So then I think the question for the committee really is, how much more of an improvement can we be assured simply by changing technology? Are we able to assure ourselves? There isn't anything in here from the reports from the other states that show that the data has moved their findings away from the national standard at a higher rate of significance than the system we already have in place. So I need to know, I think, before we make this kind of investment, that that it will do that, that the cost savings is in addition to what you've already achieved. And Madam Chair, I would also ask, is not only the cost savings from not making fraudulent payment, but also because the presenters have talked about time, savings of time, and whether or not the new technology, are you able to speak to whether or not, from DHS's perspective, the new technology would create savings for the department in terms of time, amount of effort and expenditure and on the upfront predictive modeling process?
Ms. Alexander, Ms. Knirth?
Madam Chair and member, the time savings is often, would likely be found more on the back end in the pay and chase in terms of investigations. But the focus of our agency has always been on the preventive end, and to emphasize up front, we only have like 8 investigators. And a lot of the scope of what was described to you would require field work and investigation, and that's not cost-effective time. What we do is, when we find a case and we find an investigation and find an issue, our first job is to turn that into another edit so that the whole provider type stops doing whatever we found happens whenever possible. So our goal is not to, our priority is not to realize recoveries. That happens as part of our work, but our job one is to propose more edits to Adrienne for her system to add, so the 2,000 edits grow all the time. And so that's the time would be in the fact that we wouldn't need to dramatically increase our investigative staff. So if we can strengthen and make our upfront prepayment edits even more robust, there will be less, you know, field work and case-by-case-by-case investigations later on. But then it makes it much harder to predict where the cost avoidance will occur, because we're not sure which provider type will find more, you know, potential areas to edit against. So it's very hard to predict. I don't know if that helps.
Madam Chair,
Senator Sharon.
So based on what you just said, that the savings that you would anticipate would be on the trying to recover what you've lost in payments. You wouldn't have to spend as much time doing that. So that's where the time savings is, if you can improve the front-end predictability. But are you able to say, are you able to indicate that a new technology will improve this upfront predictability from what we already have? Is there a significant improvement worthy of an expenditure other than the one we're already making?
Madam Chair, member, I think that's the absolutely right question, and we can't tell. We can't say at this point, because we don't know what the review of our current edit system will identify. Our PERM results in the second round were better than our first PERM results, and these PERM result percentages are error rates, and our error rates are far below that of the national average. And our last round, we got even better results. So there's always room for improvements. There's always new abusive practices coming up. We get reports from the feds about different gangs coming in from the coast, trying all kinds of different things. So there's always new areas of abuse. So we welcome a new resource to look at our prepayment edits, but I'm really sorry, we cannot predict how much and where we will avoid more costs at this point.
And one final question.
Sharon.
Thank you for your generosity. Are we good at recovery on the back end? Are we successful in recovery?
Ms. Knurr?
Madam Chair, members, I would say we're not particularly good at recoveries because we don't pay the claim to begin with. Our current system denies about 1 out of 5 claims we get in.
Wow.
So other states who don't have a robust edit system delight in telling us how much savings and recoveries they get because they paid those 5 claims to begin with, and we don't. We don't pay them because the client isn't eligible, the provider isn't eligible, the client died, the services was excessive beyond our limits, all the 2,000 edits that Adrian has. So we are not a particularly strong recovery. Every time when we go to a national conference and we hear from another state of the recovery and we ask them what they recovered on, it was always something that we don't let in the door, like paying managed care claims on a fee-for-service basis when we've already paid them a capitation. New York recovered $45 million on that, and I said, why did you let it in the door? They said, well, we don't have a good system. So it's very hard to judge state-to-state efforts. We returned, I think, $19 million to the general fund this past year, but that was a particularly good year for us. Normally it's more in the range of several million. But that's on those individual cases that we investigate after we've cleared the 2,000 edits.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Welcome. Senator Birkeland?
Yes, Madam Chair. You know, this was the subject of a legislative audit a couple of years ago, and since we have a lot of new people, Ms. Kunrath, I thought maybe you could refresh our memories about it. My own recollection is that the study showed that most of the fraud is committed by providers, and most of the fraud in Minnesota is caught before it happens. And so, I mean, if the legislative auditor has come to that conclusion, I just am wondering what the return on these additional expenditures would be. And I guess I think when we're in a budget deficit, we really need to see return on expenditure.
Ms. Knurth.
Madam Chair. Senator Birkeland, yes, the OLA has done a number of audits on how we conduct oversight around overpayments and things like that, and the results are mixed, but it is, as you say, they acknowledged the strength of our system. I think the potential for this legislation is in catching new areas of abuse and fraud that we don't even know about. I mean, we welcome the idea of assessing our current edit system, but it is so hard to predict. The monies in the fiscal note of our costs are the state share because we would get substantial federal match for this software or this investment, but it is very hard to predict at this point what, if any, we could avoid in costs attributable just to substantial new edits.
Is there any further discussion on the bill? There is a Mr. Tennyson who would like to testify. Please come up. Welcome, Mr. Tennyson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robert Tennyson. I'm with Tennyson Law in Minneapolis, and I represent a company called Reed Elsevier, which is a large company headquartered in London. They have a number of companies that are involved in this sort of business, and I commend Senator Benson for bringing this bill forward. I do have some questions about it and the way it is set up. This is a kind of a thing that my client, LexisNexis, part of Reed Elsevier, would likely be interested in. However, having practiced law for quite a long time, involved in some procurement contracts, it's always nice to be able to set the criteria so that your company qualifies and others don't. I don't know whether these are the proper criteria or not. And I think the department ought to review that and determine whether these are the kind of criteria that you would put into a contract. Secondly, the I think it's a little unusual to have a requirement that department must enter into a contract. Usually it's given the authority to do so when it makes sense. So my only comments are that I think the we'd like some time to take a look at this bill, look at the criteria, and probably advise the committee on that, whether that's a proper. And I think the also it would be helpful for the department to make some suggestions on criteria if this is the route you want to go. I don't have any problem with the concept of it. I think it's a good idea to prevent fraud wherever you can. Whether these are the proper criteria and whether they spec everybody else out of the market is another question. And I don't have the answer to that. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Higgins.
And Madam Chair, and I believe that some of the questions that Senator Newman was asking about, could we see other proposals that that this particular company I had done previously could give us ideas about what criteria were used in at least some other state. And maybe Mr. Tennyson, his client, could propose some other ideas that seem to be lacking that might move us forward.
Madam Chair, I think that
Mr. Tennyson,
that'd be appropriate. Also, in a payment system, some companies may be willing to provide you the software for on a basis to not charge for it, and you can see how it works for you and whether it's something you really want to enter into. And I think that's another option, not just entering a contract, but give you the software to practice, you know, to work your data and see whether it makes a difference. So I think it's a good idea, and I commend Senator Benson for doing this, because I think anytime we can avoid improper payments, it's a good thing for the state and the taxpayers. But I think look carefully at what the criteria is, because when I write a contract for, if I'm writing an RFP and I had, or I always like to influence an RFP in my client's favor, so be warned. Thank you.
Senator Berkley.
Madam Chair, I think that Mr. Tennyson raises a good point that oftentimes these kind of contracts are entered into on a recovery basis so that the contract says they will provide the technology and the first so many percent of dollars will go to the vendor to offset the cost of the technology. And it seems to me, since we're not really sure if this is going to get us any more recoveries, that perhaps that would be a better approach to take in regard to this area.
And Senator Benson and members, these are very valid questions. This bill, if it does pass, will be referred to Finance Committee, and I believe the discussion can continue on with that. And Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, would this not be a bill that we would lay aside for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill? I don't know why we would send it to Finance. It has a cost, and this division's bill would likely be the one to pay for it. So I would assume that this would be the start of our omnibus bill.
Mm-hmm. Senator Higgins, I believe with this late fiscal note that just came in as of a couple minutes ago, and the chair Hand's motion or wishes were to send it on to Finance. So, but that we can send it on to Finance and possibly include it into the bill too.
Madam Chair, can
Senator
you give
Higgins
us some indication? Are the divisions going, that would be us, this committee, going to be assembling the omnibus bills, or is this something the Finance Committee is going to be doing? Are y'all making a big change from how we have done things in the past?
Well, yeah, you can dual track it, right? Yeah. Senator Higgins, we could dual track this also.
Why would you?
Could you?
Why wouldn't you, Senator Higgins?
Well, Madam Chair, it needs to be paid for, which means it has to be tracked in some bill, right? And it's a Health and Human Services issue, so it likely should be tracked in the Health and Human Services bill.
Okay.
So why would we not send it to Finance, but instead leave it here for when we're putting together our omnibus bill, have it be part of that bill? I mean, that's kind of how we have done these things in the past. I know it's a new day, but.
Senator Higgins, I appreciate your viewpoints on this, and this was discussed yesterday, not knowing if there was going to be a fiscal note or not. I am just the vice chair on this, and Chair Han will determine the direction of this bill. It can be dual-tracked, as we have been told, so we'll dual-track it.
Madam Chair?
Senator Lurie.
All due respect, this is a really good question that Senator Higgins brings up, and one that the members of this committee really deserve a thorough answer to. What would be the criteria used to determine what we lay over and what we send on? I mean, I think that we really need to know this. I mean, some of the things that have bypassed this committee and this, I mean, truthfully, this committee was scheduled overlapping with another committee that both Senator Sharon and I sit on, at least on Mondays. And I mean, if honestly, we're sitting here going, if we're not going to have jurisdiction over this budget, why would we show up?
We're here.
And so we need to know what the criteria is going to be for what we have jurisdiction over in this committee. Process is very, very important, and we haven't seen what this criteria is. So, I mean, maybe you can't speak to it right now, but this is something that we can expect to hear a lot more about as we progress. And it, and they're very real, legitimate, and grave concerns that we have, and that really protect the public process. I mean, this is, you know, it's through our committee process that the public in Minnesota is invited in to weigh in on what we do here at the state capitol. And these are major changes, and we have yet to have very satisfactory answers to some of these very fundamental questions that are coming up.
Senator Lurie, this, you know, very eloquently said, and absolutely appreciate your opinion, and Senator Higgins and everybody at this table. You know, you do have a right to hear that, and promise we will have that discussion. Okay, I am just sitting in the chair's chair. And there's the chair.
Ah.
Perfect timing.
So, Madam Chair,
we can dual track this. We can dual track this. Yeah. However, we need to brief the chair on this information. Okay, and we will have an answer. Okay,
Madam Chair,
and Senator Higgins,
if we dual track it. Take off my glasses here because I'm seeing a couple of you. So it would then go to finance and then presumably to the floor. And then we could vote on it. But what happens then, and we'll all have voted to, you know, make this bill pass. So then on its other track, when we put together our budget, we may decide that this isn't as important as other things that are in our budget, and then it would fall to the side. So we voted to make it pass and implement it, but then we're going to undo it or not do it or something. It gets messy, I think, is what I'm trying to say. And then in addition, we just had some suggestions for language that could maybe strengthen the bill. Senator Berglund talked about maybe some stronger language about the vendor sharing in the cost recovery and all those kinds of things. I think that's a great idea. I think possibly we could maybe have some help from Senate counsel on an amendment to that. Mr. Tennyson suggested that on line 1.23, must enter into a contract is maybe not the right language. It should be something about maybe the department's empowered to or whatever the language is that we use. So I think maybe our work on the bill as a division or a policy committee, whichever we want to be right now, isn't quite done. And so I'm thinking that laying it aside for possible inclusion would give us time to continue work on it so that it's as good a bill as we need it to be.
Mm-hmm. Senator Higgin, I do trust Senator Benson to continue this work on this bill and work with all the parties. I'm sure you'll do that, Senator Benson. You've done a great job with it to date, and really truly appreciate all the suggestions. This, of course, since there is a fiscal note, will be in our division spreadsheet, but I don't see any problem why we cannot send it on to finance. Is that your wishes, Mr. Chair?
Okay.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I like the suggestion of Senator Berglund, and I'd like to ask Senate Counsel have an amendment on line 1.23 to strike must and insert may, and then figure out, I don't know what kind of language Senate Counsel would propose, but I really think, based on the testimony, I think this could be a tremendous thing, but again, it also sounds like we're not going to get what we got in other states, and if we had it so that the vendor would, that they would sign a contract where the vendor puts up the money up front, and if it has the savings there, I mean, just if it makes it, they get the first part of the savings back in order to cover the costs and so on. Work out a contract like that so the state doesn't put in the risk, and if it's a good system, it could save us a lot of money, but and obviously would help the vendor as well, but that way the state's not on the risk in case it doesn't have the savings, and I guess I'm impressed by the numbers on that second or so page of the handout, how good the department's been doing. So I guess I'd like to see if they can get an amendment that would do that risk where they put up a risk up front.
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, in looking at this, and I know there are people uncomfortable with the Commissioner Must, we've had several false starts with this, and that's why when I looked at the must, it seemed heavy-handed. But we have stopped and started attempts to give better tools to this department to prevent some of this waste, fraud, and abuse on the front end. And that's why I remain comfortable with the language must. Referring to the contract, shall incorporate performance-based vendor financing option whereby the vendor shares in the risk of the project's success. I think that gives enough latitude for the chair, or I'm sorry, for the commissioner to structure a contract that says state money is not on the line until you show us you can perform. I think this directs action but gives latitude. And so I am not comfortable at this time waiting for an amendment.
Madam Chair,
well, I would like to offer an amendment that does accomplish that. She can oppose it, but I'd like to at least offer the amendment.
Okay. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, the last time I looked, the Finance Committee didn't have a little secret pot of gold. So, you know, this bill, the way it's drafted now, has a fiscal note, and unless there's going to be some bill that's sent to Finance to pay for it separately, I don't know how the Finance Committee could pass this bill because they haven't paid for it. So, you know, to me, there's one of two options. One, you amend the bill so you get rid of the fiscal note, or you put in an omnibus bill and show us what you're going to cut to pay for it.
Well, Senator Berglund, I do believe that this will be in the bill, but I still think you can, and it's been verified, you can still can track that and send it to Finance. So,
right, but they have to have a way to pay for it, Madam Chair, before they can send it out.
Yeah,
so what is the point?
So what's the point
in sending it to another committee that doesn't have any money to pay for it?
Senator Berglund, I believe Senator Benson is going to be working on this and to continue working on this.
I will continue to make efforts to move this through the process. I am comfortable with dual tracking. That leaves the discretion of the chair and this committee in play. And so I respectfully take your input and will consider that as I move forward.
But, Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
It's a waste of time to send it to Finance. I'm just going to be blunt. You're just going to take up time in a committee that, unless, like Senator Berglund says, they've got a pot of gold someplace, isn't going to be able to move it forward, and they're going to send it back here, or they should send it back here, because this is where it should stay. There's nothing wrong with laying this aside for inclusion in the omnibus bill. It doesn't make your bill better, worse, or liked or not liked. It's just the process, and it should just stay here. And I don't understand this whole send everything to finance, because finance can't do anything with it anyway, except send it to the floor where we can't do anything with it. So it should just stay here. We'd all like it to stay here. And then you can continue to work on it when we bring it up again for inclusion in the omnibus bill. The amendments can be prepared if they're not done today. And this committee can do its work, policy and finance. That's what we do here, I guess.
Senator Lurie.
Towards that end, and honestly trying to be helpful, you know, Senator Benson has committed that she's going to continue to work on this and on the fiscal note that just came in. And an option is to lay it over for possible inclusion, allow Senator Benson to continue to work on this. If the expectation is that we get the fiscal note cleaned up, it can go at that point. I mean, our point, the issue is it really can't until that's worked on. I mean, and if it is the sincere belief that that's able to be addressed, let's keep it here, address the issue, and then let it go. I mean, that's what we do. And it's a reasonable approach.
Senator Benson?
I will respectfully consider the advice of the chair.
Okay. Senator Birkeland?
Well, Madam Chair, if the intention is that Senator Benson will work on changing the bill in a way that it doesn't have a fiscal note, it could just be laid over here and then brought up again when those amendments are ready and when that fiscal note is ready, and then it could go straight to the floor. It seems to me having the Finance Committee do policy work to remove a fiscal note is ill-advised. I mean, really, there's only a couple of us on the Finance Committee that are on this committee, and most of the rest of the people on the Finance Committee really don't understand this area very well. So,
okay. Very good discussion, members. And as the chair, Senator Han, I've been advised that this can send along, and we can track it in our budget. But to make peace in the valley and to have Senator Benson to continue to work on this and respectfully presenting a bill that meets her needs and the needs of the situation, I think we will lay it over for possible inclusion, if that's okay with you, Senator Benson. And but we still have, do you have a motion, Senator Murray?
Madam Chair, I had an amendment that Senate Council has. It may not be perfect, but I would love to float it, see if people think it works.
Madam Chair and members, on page 2, line 1, strike everything after shall and strike line 2 as well, and after shall insert, well, actually I'll read the whole sentence. The contract shall pay the vendor on a contingency basis whereby the vendor assumes the upfront cost of the system and services and is only reimbursed if savings are realized, period.
Ms. Kavanaugh, does that also include the 1.2, line 1.23, the strike must and put in may?
Madam
also?
Chair, no, I think her point was the department is much more likely to do it, and if we have it as a contingency fee-based thing, I mean, they still have the flexibility if they don't get a contract that works, but I think if we direct them to do it and make sure that the vendor is assuming the upfront costs, then the state could benefit if it's a very beneficial thing, and if it's not going to, then the state's not out, so it wouldn't be.
Okay. And Ms. Kavanaugh, can you say that again? After shall pay the vendor on a contingency basis.
The contract shall pay the vendor on a contingency basis whereby the vendor assumes the upfront cost of the system and services and is only reimbursed if savings are realized, period.
Chair.
Senator Lurie.
If Senator Benson wants to reply first, I don't know.
She's still writing. Okay. this is a long amendment.
On the amendment.
Senator Lori.
Madam Chair, I think that that does make the must enter into a contract a little bit more problematic, actually, because there could be a situation where, upon further analysis, the RFP is let, the vendors look at it, and it doesn't seem to be beneficial to a contractor to have this language that the agency must enter into a contract that doesn't work for any vendor. We could be caught in a catch-22 there. I mean, I think it might be wiser to allow Senator Benson. I mean, I think we've had a very good discussion, as you mentioned earlier, and I think we get kind of the levers that we're talking about here, maybe a better route rather than adopting this amendment that does, in my mind, create a problem there if the agency finds itself in a position where there isn't a vendor that would take such a contract. The must and this criteria could be in conflict. It might be better to just allow Senator Benson the freedom to go and work on these issues and come back to us with what works.
Senator Benson?
I am certainly willing to do more work, and I'd appreciate any input that Senator Lori might share in improving this bill.
Okay. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, and Senator Lori, the beginning of that sentence does cover for that if there aren't responses for the request, and there's not reason that we cover it. But I'll withdraw the amendment because I think it would be better if it's worked on more carefully.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Marty. Senator Berkley.
Well, I was just going to say that the must only applies to issuing a request for proposals. It doesn't require the department to enter into a contract unless there would be a contract where the vendor would take it on a contingency basis. So
I think you're wrong on that.
I think the language was okay.
I read it differently.
All right. So the motion has been withdrawn. And we will refer this, lay this over on the table, but just to make sure everybody understands, this is, it can be dual-tracked. We have been verified by Ms. Kavanaugh, says it can be dual-tracked. But Senator Benson, do you have a motion?
I move Senate File 180 to be laid over for further consideration at the discretion of the chair.
Okay, super. Senator Benson has moved that Senate File 180 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those in favor opposed? No. Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Benson. Senator Scheid.
I need a break. I need a break.
There's our pile.
Paper pile.
Body break. What's that?
That's all right.
Section 125 of the bill is.
Thank you, Senator Rosen, for filling in. I had a bill I was presenting in the Commerce Committee, and I just was visiting with Senator Scheid. So thank you for dual tracking your own life here, and welcome to the
yes,
committee.
Thank you.
And I'll turn it over to you. You may tell us what you wish about the bill, and we'll go from there.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Senate File 191 is pretty straightforward. If you have it in front of you, I'm sure you do. It repeals 62U.07, and let me tell you what that is. That is the section of statute that deals with Section 125 plans, which is part of the federal tax code. I assume the members of the committee are familiar with that. It was set up in the federal code. It enables employers to administer, I guess is the right word, the health insurance purchases of their employees when the employer is not offering a health insurance benefit. And so they use pre-tax dollars in transit, obviously, to the employee. The employer then doesn't pay the FICA or Social Security on those pre-tax dollar expenditures. But the truth of the matter is that it's not being used very much, and many more employers are just opting out because our statute also allows the opt-out. Now, last year, the last session, we established a working group. It was called a Small Group Health Insurance Market Working Group. And the challenge for that working group, and it was part of the Healthcare Access Commission, and we kind of, it wasn't in the legislation, but I think we just kind of incorporated it into that because that was functioning and operating as well this past year. They were looking at a variety of ways to help small and mid-sized businesses with their health insurance costs, obviously a tremendous challenge. And so the working group had small and mid-sized employers. It had employees of those firms, had insurance agents, actuaries, and other people, particularly from the Department of Commerce. And we're going to continue to work through the rest of this year, but this is the first consensus recommendation out of that working group. And, in fact, it's the only one so far. So and it just it repeals the current mandate for businesses that don't offer group health insurance. And the truth of the matter is it's just not helping get more people covered in any case. And so that is kind of the underlying reason for it. Maybe I can look at, it is the only recommendation so far from that working group. It's a tough challenge. We wanted to look at small employers are from two to are defined as employing between an average of 2 to 50 employees, and there were folks in the business community who would like to take that up to 100. You kind of run into the same problem. You hit 51 and you go off a cliff. Well, if you hit 100, you go off a cliff we had actuaries that were part of the working group. It's very interesting and dry stuff, but it's a very, the challenge is enormous, and just trying to make that decision about where that cutoff should be. So we didn't really make progress on that, but we did come up with this as one thing that would take away one regulation that would be probably, it's not obviously going to get more people covered, but it's not happening in any case. For example, there was a state grant program of up to $350 to assist these small businesses with the expenses of setting up the 125 plans. You know, you need a CPA or somebody to come in and help you set it up. And there, I think, only six employers applied for the grant, so almost $1 million, I think. I have that because Senator Lori shared with me the fiscal note. $1 million was set aside in the Healthcare Access Fund, and the grants that were awarded were only $2,100. So almost $1 million was canceled by us last year. So, and there is no other fiscal implication as I see the note.
Thank you, Senator Scheid. Are there questions for Senator Scheid on the bill? Any questions? Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, again, they just had to consider it, and now the trouble is they have to send in a form saying they considered it, and we're getting rid of that. Right.
Senator
Scheid. Bill, if nobody else does.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Senator Scheid, thank you. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Scheid, is this the what we commonly know as the cafeteria plan that is being proposed to be repealed?
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, maybe you can help me on that. I don't know if that's what – I assume it's part of it.
And Senator Newman, I worked for a company that had a Section 125. It was – I guess you could refer to it as a cafeteria style. What it did, it allowed certain things to be funded through pre-tax dollars, and they were specified. I don't think it's entirely a cafeteria plan because I think that's more you select benefits out of an existing set, and I don't think this is quite the same, but maybe council, do you have any, is that a term of art or is that a defined term? A cafeteria plan, is that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, I think Mr. Chair has kind of described it correctly. 125 plans allows you to take certain things as pre-tax dollars.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. I have the book, so here, and it specifically talks about a Section 125 plan means a cafeteria or premium-only plan. And that's the reason I asked Senator Scheid that question. I'm not trying to trick her. My concern is that I don't understand the ramifications of the proposed repeal at this point. And I don't, you know, I have lots of employers in my district that employ 2 to 50 people. So I'm really concerned about agreeing to a repeal of a health care plan that I don't understand.
And Mr. Senator Newman and Senator Scheid, did you want to respond to
Mr.
that?
Mr. Chairman, just that this would repeal the mandate. I mean, it doesn't do away with the plan.
Senator Newman, that was going to be my comment. I think what this does is it requires companies who don't have such a plan to implement one if they don't provide a group health insurance plan. That's all, as I understand it. And what we're saying is that mandated implementation of a Section 125 plan is what they've agreed is not necessary or not effective, and so they're repealing the mandate. And Senator Berglund, did you have a...
It doesn't even mandate that they provide a 125 benefit. It just mandates that they look into it before they reject it.
Yeah.
And being that it isn't being enforced, and there hasn't been very much take-up, I mean, this was a pretty watered-down version of something that Governor Pawlenty proposed and then decided he didn't like his own proposal, and so this is kind of what we ended up with, and I think it's pretty clear now it didn't work very well. So probably repealing it would be a good idea.
Thanks, Senator Berglund. Sometimes we don't like our own proposals after a while. I know that happens. But I think, as I recall, and Senator Scheid, you might remind me, I think the Section 125 plans require that participants agree before the year to donate or contribute a certain amount of money into these plans. But if they don't use all the money, then the money goes away. It's not returned to the individual. So there's a certain risk that you take in signing up for 125. And it's a good plan, but... It's Section 125 does not do that. Maybe I'm misspeaking. I won't get into that. This has nothing to do with the bill. But
Senator Scheid. Mr. Chairman, actually, and the employer doesn't make any contribution. This is a matter of where the employer is kind of the administrator for the employees to choose their own plan, and then they handle the accounting. Aspect of that. The employer does handle that aspect, but they don't contribute.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions for Senator Scheid? Senator Marty, I'm sorry, Senator Higgins.
I'll move the bill.
Senator Marty, I think, already moved the bill.
Oh, sorry.
We'll recognize Senator Marty's prior motion, and Senator Marty moves that the Senate File 191 be passed and referred to Commerce Committee? Is that where it is?
I expect, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Marty makes the motion to pass Senate File 191 and refer to Commerce. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The ayes have it. The bill's passed. Thank you.
Thank you.
And members, there's no other further business before the committee. We will be adjourned.